University.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another one of the special interviews that I'm doing this week. On Monday, I talked to Fraser Folly Todd about problems with the dissident right and how it doesn't really exist anymore and how it didn't go anywhere. Then I talked to Caleb Morpin about, you know, the fake left and the real left. Now I have Haz, who's also a well-known leftist, and he has recently been to China. So we're going to be talking about that. But before we get going, Haz, if people haven't seen you before, tell us a bit about yourself.
So I go by Haz al-Din. I'm the executive chairman of the American Communist Party. And I've been known for years as the host or the face of the Infrared show, the Infrared Movement, basically a politically incorrect left-wing subculture that, you know, is seen as culturally conservative, usually, and oftentimes clashes with the mainstream leftist consensus, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I guess what people would know as the woke left.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. More or less.
Yeah, I actually came across you when I was researching. I've been making videos on Stalin, just kind of interested to build up a picture of what went on. And some of your older videos were really helpful in kind of getting some of my bearings on that. But we're actually going to talk today about China, because recently you went over there. Is that right? You've been on a trip to China. And one of the things with China that I've always had is that to us here, it's opaque. You know, we're told things about it, but I have no conception of how, you know, what China is like, or, you know, how it's doing on the ground. So, yeah, what were your experiences of China?
Well, although I was only there for 5 days, you know, I'm pretty acquainted with kind of China's history and China's system and kind of even to some extent their culture. And I have to say that the first impression that was made upon me that I found so striking about China when I was there, you know, and people will talk about how high tech it is, and people will talk about how just like orderly it is, the lack of crime, the lack of dirt on the street, how everything is just, there's a level of competency that is just excels what we're used to in modern societies. And by the way, all those things are completely true. But I think that the thing that struck me the most was something different. It was more about, I've never seen modern life flow this seamlessly in a society. It's the facilitation of people getting from A to B. It's the facilitation of people going to their jobs, coming back, getting, you know, going out, getting food, shopping, doing what they need to do. There's such a seamless and harmonious level of flow going on, right, in some kind of way. And I found that very striking for a modern society, because typically in modern societies, we regard them as hectic and chaotic and kind of alienating. You know, when you go to New York City or you go to a major big city in Western countries, oftentimes, you know, you just see a lot of pandemonium, basically. What else can we call it? And then the harmony that I'm talking about is typically something we regard as something that we see in the countryside. You know, we see it in the peaceful, you know, idyllic small farms or something. But what was interesting to me about China is how comprehensive and harmonious the modern civilization they've built is. And that was a very new experience, actually. Everything is so interrelated, you know.
What is it that is facilitated? I mean, is it that they've put on trams or public transport, or like, what do you think it is that's making it kind of flow, as you put it?
I think that behind the surface, so to speak, of, you know, just like a typical modern, you know, capitalist society, I guess, China is a very comprehensive society. It's everything. It's not that everything is directly planned from a center, but there is an interface going on between the center and what's going on, you know, at the periphery. There's inputs and outputs that are constantly working together, and it is very much, you know, a planned society, just not in the sense of the 20th century where, you know, you had a one center, like a command that was just kind of distributing information in one kind of way. China is a society where things are intentional. The way things are supposed to work is very intentional, very purposeful. And this, everything fits together in like a collectively harmonious way and a socially harmonious way. And I think what that actually reflects is China is what a modern socialist civilization looks like in the 21st century, you know? And I think that's really the crux of it. All the things that, you know, people typically mention, public transportation, all these other kind of things, those are there for sure. But it's the way that all of these things work together, how everyday experiences by ordinary people are able to be, and this kind of sounds a little dystopian, but they're able to be regarded and collected as a kind of data that feeds up and is then used to refine and improve those experiences. It's
I've lost your sound there, Haz. Sorry. Maybe muted. Hello?
How about now?
Yeah, I've got you back. Sorry.
Yeah.
Say that last bit again.
It may sound dystopian, but yeah, China's a big data society for certain. But it's the when the collection and you know the usage of the data is entrusted in the public interest, the results are actually quite evidently favorable to human beings rather than you know hostile and malign to them.
Well, we can get into some of the working. So I guess you're talking in some respect about the social credit system, which is, you know, used to, you're not talking about that.
No. That kind of system is very misunderstood, I think, in Western countries. And you don't see anything like that, you know, publicly. What I'm more talking about is like how deliberate and carefully things are planned around improving people's experiences, and not only improving them, but just ensuring that there is a competency and an ability for life to be facilitated, for the way of life to be facilitated. So for example, like, I don't know, like if it's common that people, you know, take so and so long to get in line for a public transit place or something, things are refined and everything is just so adjusted based on, you know, making that shorter, you know, making the line shorter, for example. I mean, that's just like something that would come off the top of my head. But there's things that like are so convenient there that are not here, which makes it feel like this is a society that cares about the experiences of its citizens. It's kind of more what I'm talking about, I guess.
All right. So before we get to, you know, how it works at a political level, one question I've got, I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to do this, when I saw that you'd been to China, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is because in my years of being online, whenever I mention China on Twitter, whenever I've mentioned China on a stream, always, immediately, I get flooded by people coming up with all sorts of reasons why China's actually failing. So my question is, why are so many Westerners so loath to give China any credit? Why is it all anything good is always explained away by some other thing? And then why do they have to constantly claim, a la Peter Zahan or somebody like this, that China is about to collapse, that its demographics are terrible, that it's full of ghost cities? You know, these are the things that will routinely come up if you ever mention China in any sort of positive context. So why do you think that is? Why do you think Westerners are so geared to hating China in that way?
Well, I begin by simplifying it as bog standard anti-communism, which won't sound compelling at the outset, but to explain, we are very much, as a consequence of the remnant of the Cold War and the anti-communist history of Western societies, I guess, we believe that when societies, when there are deliberate you know, comprehensive and deliberate agendas behind society. When a society is not supposedly natural and spontaneously emergent from the anarchy of the market or civil society, when there is some kind of like agential motivation or force that is behind, you know, the development of a society, you know, like the CPC in China is responsible for the development of China. We tend to regard that as, you know, a scam or something, or we regard it as a dystopia. We regard it as a type of tyranny. We regard it as a vain attempt to maintain a type of control that is not possible. We think that it's impossible to control society in the way that the Chinese government, you know, controls Chinese society. Society, to a great extent, is in the hands of this, you know, I don't know if we would call it the invisible hand or some kind of like empty, completely inhuman force, so to speak, which is not accountable to anyone, which is not, you know, answerable to anything. And, you know, we consider our liberal democracies to be free, spontaneous, unplanned.
Emergent is the word I hear a lot. You know, so someone has written a lot on elite theory.
Yeah.
Where I think that a lot of things are actually top down, even in our systems. And very little is left to chance the more you learn about it.
Mm.
But a lot of people's default response is to think, well, it's emergent.
It's neoliberal ideology. Of course, yeah. I say this. My opinion is that we live in planned societies too.
Mm-hmm.
But we have an ideology which makes our experience of this planned society something that actually is a consequence of our own individual freedom and our emergent, you know, will as a people, which is just not the case. But in any case, as a consequence of this ideology, I guess, this outlook, it's very easy for people to like look at China, which is a pretty openly deliberate planned society with intentions, which does things with intention based on goals, and say, you know, that's not going to work. That's completely going to fail. That's, you know, that's just some vain thing that, you know, some power center is doing that clearly is not going to. For the same reason, Western commentators think that any day now the grip of the CPC is going to loosen and there's going to be a mass uprising within China, and, you know, the citizens are going to rise up and institute a liberal democracy or something. And I would say, you know, as a final note, you know, there are two worlds. They're very much still a bipolar world, I think, since the Cold War. Two different ways of processing modern history. And we had one way. And then the other world, the communist world, had another way of doing that and experiencing that. And China is like one of the last places where that other perspective of the bipolar world actually still predominates. If you go to China, and for example, you talk about Joseph Stalin, mm-hmm. they have a very balanced, normal kind of like, well, Stalin was great. Stalin was, what he did was absolutely, you know, he created socialism in one country. That was a very important foundation for us. And even to whatever extent Stalin is regarded in a negative light in China, you know, they'll just say, well, he was too inflexible when it came to certain questions, when it came to China, when it came to other countries. So, and this is a normal, like 21st century, extremely dynamic modern society. And they have a completely different, and I'm talking about an ordinary, everyday level, a completely different way of processing modern history. And even the experience of today's history, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for example, when it comes to the Russia-Ukraine war, there's nothing controversial within China about saying that this was a war provoked by NATO.
Mm-hmm.
There's and people that are saying stand with Ukraine in China, you're seen as a nut job. You know, you're seen as like crazy. So, and even to an extent, the Chinese don't fully understand this, because, you know, China is a modern, normal society, and then they see that the West at least in some elite circles, at least kind of looks like a modern normal society. So oftentimes there's just an inability to communicate because China does have a different perspective about the bipolar world that they take for granted. And we have one that we take for granted. And it all comes from the Cold War, you know, and it's actually still ongoing. So it's kind of fascinating.
So there's kind of two levels of Western responses that I find when it comes to China. One is just, you know, the list of Peter Zahan copes, okay? But the second one basically says, yeah, okay, China has come a long way, right? But really, since Deng, it's capitalism. It's state-backed capitalism, and it hasn't really been communist or socialist since the days of Mao. How do you respond to people who say, well, like, it's not really, it's basically just capitalism again? What's the answer to that? Yeah.
To be as brief as possible, China's unique form of socialism did not begin with Deng. It actually began with Mao and with the CPC around the end of the beginning before the first five-year plan that they had. Mm-hmm. So when the CPC took power, they very deliberately did not want to adopt the Soviet model of socialism and planning. They wanted their own, this was the new democracy period. So they wanted to retain aspects of the old in the cities, you know, to some extent, the old capitalist society. And they wanted to just kind of oversee it and develop the forces of production and basically, you know, develop socialism on more peaceful lines in a less disruptive way and a more seamless transition. Mm-hmm. The first five-year plan kind of changed that. The injection of Soviet aid and the Soviet loans made China resemble, in many respects, the Soviet Union in terms of the way in which it was planning the society, the way in which it was developing the society. And gave China more confidence in terms of, you know, okay, well, we can just kind of directly transition into socialism. We don't really need to go through this old stage. But at the end of the first five-year plan, they realized they were increasingly indebted to the Soviet Union and that this model of growth and development just wasn't working for China up to a point. It worked very well for the first five-year plan, but it wasn't sustainable, you know? So that is actually why China launched the infamous Great Leap Forward. And people sensationalize the Great Leap Forward, by the way, and they say, well, this is something, it killed 30 million, it killed 45 million people. We don't have to get into the specifics, but I completely reject these exaggerations. Of course, there was a tremendous crop failure in those three troubling years, as the locals call it, and it didn't go well for sure. The Great Leap Forward, I should say, but the long-term consequences of it actually were quite important and successful for laying the foundation of modern China. So under Mao, even following the Great Leap Forward, China created a very unique form of socialism that was an adaptation of the Soviet kind. And it was very distinct from the Soviet kind because it had an emphasis actually on decentralizing economic production and a strong focus on medium to small sized industries and rural industry on a mass scale. The Soviet Union kind of had this type of socialism where, you know, you had the state, state was just owned all of the enterprises and the companies and some farms. And then you had kolkhozes, which were cooperatives owned by peasants. And then that was it. Well, China had something called the People's Commune. People's communes owned industries. They owned the farms. They owned the agriculture and schools and infrastructure. And that was all like devolved from the level of the central state government. People's communes were not the same thing as the state government. They built much of the infrastructure, the waterworks, the irrigation, tunnels, roads, bridges, and so on and so on. that by the late 70s could be used as a foundation for Deng Xiaoping's reform and opening up for the household responsibility system. But throughout the, from Mao's Great Leap Forward to Deng Xiaoping's reform, even through the most radical phases of the Cultural Revolution, we witnessed a process of the devolution of planning from the center, you know, down to the People's Commune, then down to the brigades within the communes, then down to the teams as the unit of account. By the time Deng rolls around, he just makes one final step from the team to the individual, or not the individual, the family. And that was the household responsibility system. And it was all about a more efficient unit of account. The planning system was still in place. Okay, the paradigm that this is a planned economy and that this whole thing is set up to facilitate the goals of the party, none of that ever changed with Deng. What changed is that the unit of account went from the team level to the household level. And so China, you know, it looked like it appeared to become capitalist and loosen up from being socialist, because this was what was going on in the world with Gorbachev in the Soviet Union and then in the Eastern Bloc, and then finally they dissolved. Everyone was thinking, well, China's basically in a roundabout way doing the same thing. But in reality, China's form of socialism, which began with Mao, was just becoming more dynamic and sophisticated and adapted to itself. It was never fully fleshed out under Mao. You know, there were aspects of the Soviet-style socialist planning under Mao that people associate with socialism in general, but that wasn't ever how the Chinese saw socialism. They never saw it as one for one the Soviet model. They always envisioned it to be something more dynamic, more fluid, more comprehensive, and so on. And, you know, so Deng Xiaoping's reforms, it's easy to say, well, he introduced market reforms, he introduced, and I think the thing that really is convincing to people, actually, is the consumerism. The fact that China was opened up to the soft power culture of the West through the consumption of light goods like McDonald's and Mickey Mouse and Western media. And, you know, most people, I think most midwits actually, they'll think of capitalism, like, well, that's Coca-Cola, that's blue jeans, that's whatever. And it's like, no, that's an extremely superficial analysis. If we're talking on a systemic level, not on a cultural level, because remember, China already went through the Cultural Revolution. They'd been there, done that when it came to, you know, attempting to search for the essence of socialism strictly through gatekeeping and controlling what they consume culturally. And you know, at the end of that, they did that so thoroughly and comprehensively that culture for them no longer became politically significant at all. They took it to such an extreme that they just realized they've exhausted it as much as it could be, and they don't really see it as political. So, you know, for China, Mickey Mouse and McDonald's and Nike, that's not anything political. That's not capitalism. That's not anything. And actually, as you can see now, Chinese people are getting quite bored of it. You know, they're searching for something else. Consumerism doesn't affect China the same way it does the West, not in the sense that they consume less or want to consume less, but more at the ideological level. It doesn't work on their consciousness in the same way it works on ours, to where it has these political consequences. We thought that because we were going to be able to exert such a tremendous soft power on China following the reform and opening up, that the next logical step is that China's going to become a liberal democracy, that the power of the CPC is going to be eroded. Nothing like that happened. That China became very bored, they were yawning, and they were not really impressed with the, especially now. I mean, if you look at Chinese responses to Western media and movies and TV shows and stuff in like the woke period that we're in, it's very much fallen out of favor and kind of mocked and ridiculed on Chinese social media. But in any case, to get to the point, I want to say this is a final point about Chinese socialism. I don't want to ramble too much. You know, under Stalin, Stalin is famous for his notion of socialism in one country. Stalin more or less oversaw collectivization. What a lot of people don't know is that with collectivization, the collective farms weren't owned by the state. They were cooperatives that were formally, at least, owned by the peasants. And they entered into a deal with the state, an exchange, where they would sell grain to the state and in return the state would provide machinery and tractors and so on and so on. That very much created what Stalin called the socialist commodity form. That formed the outer framing for the socialist commodity form. So there were also markets in the kolkhozes, and in every socialist country, including under Mao, markets existed, market forces existed, money existed as a unit of account, okay? And that's why, you know, even under Stalin, Mussolini famously said, oh, they've abandoned Bolshevism in favor of fascism. He said that in the 30s about Stalin. Mm-hmm. And then throughout the Cold War, one of the soft power tools of the Western, like CIA left, I guess, was like, oh, this isn't real socialism. They still have these aspects of capitalist society, so they're not socialism. So mm-hmm. There's no experience of communism that exists where it wasn't being put under this extremely strawmanned, like purity litmus test of not being true socialism, and it's actually capitalism. And China today mm-hmm. is absolutely no different. The crude form of socialism that existed in the 20th century was not a consequence of ideological purity. It was a consequence of needing to create the basic premises and foundations of an industrial system by having peasants basically pool together all of their produce so that the surpluses could be extracted, so that the basic capital could be created to finance machinery and industrialization. And that's the only way you can do it if you're not taking out loans from capitalist countries that they're going to put you in debt in the long term. So that's why it was so crude and like top down. That's why there was this leveling process. Oh, this is equality. This is what communism is. In reality, that was just a kind of primitive accumulation that was needed to squeeze out extra surpluses to bankroll industrialization. It wasn't because there was a doctrine of egalitarianism necessarily that prevailed. Mm-hmm. So I just think people are confused about Marxism, at least. We do have an idea of communism in our head that it's this crude kind of everyone's the same, everything is divided equally, all wealth is seized and redistributed equally or something. That's really what comes to our head. Even in Marx's time, people had this prejudice about what communism was. But Marx was very clear. At least Marxism is different, let's say. Marx was very clear that communism isn't so much this crude process of leveling everyone to be the exact same, but it is more this historical process by which, you know, man reappropriates not only the fruits of his labor, but the means by which his labor is facilitated and put in the service of the common good. That's a very simplistic way of putting it, but and what that translates to in the case of communist states is the goal is development. The goal is developing the productive forces. Stalin and Bukharin had a dispute in the late 20s. It wasn't over ideology. Ideology was really something that took the backseat with these debates. Bukharin proposed something that the Bolsheviks at the time, Stalin, were convinced would not work to suit or meet the needs of Soviet industrialization, because they were seeing how in the countryside, you know, the kulaks were not spending their excesses of production on industrial equipment and mechanization. They were just hoarding it and using it to speculate and you know, becoming usurious with respect to the other peasants that were losing out in the market. So I think people who say China has become capitalist underestimate how pragmatic the older, cruder form of socialism actually was at the time, when it was no longer necessary, you know, by the end, let's say, of the Mao period, actually. It was actually Mao, not Deng Xiaoping, who started questioning the current course of things. It was actually Mao who was starting to entertain the possibility of doing what Deng ended up. Deng did not come to power by accident. He was put there by Mao. He's very trusted by Mao. You know, he was, Mao was the one who protected Deng throughout the entirety of the Cultural Revolution.
So, I mean, I have a couple of questions here, specific ones. I mean, we've gone into some depth, but it's worth trying to get this kind of cemented in people's minds and from my own understanding. So in China, you know, you have this, you know, devolved down to the level of the individual unit. Okay. I mean, famously for Deng, it was the farmer, right? The individual farming unit. But does the CPC still set a target or a quota, or is it more free than that? Are there any, like, I don't know, like consequences for not, because when people think of communism, they're always thinking of targets and quotas and, you know, consequences if you displease the central government and things like that. How does it actually work? Like, how hands-on are the central authority, and or is it much? Is it, you know, if one family makes a lot, can they get rich versus another family that, you know, has a bad year or whatever, and they don't do so well? You understand what I'm asking?
I think it was by the late 80s, the quota system for the family units that were the units of account for the procurement of grain, that was abolished. So there was no more quota system. The system had become smooth enough. Enough capital had become accumulated where the state no longer needed to rely on the excesses or surpluses of agricultural production to bankroll its industrialization. The industrial takeoff had already been well underway and established. So there was no quota system for any unit of Chinese society. And it is not that direct in terms of how much individuals participate in the goals, the party's goals for planning. The targets for planning, I think, are set more on a more abstract level of, you know, we want to reach this level of GDP growth. We want to reach this level of growth for the entire economy. And that's not something that's directly put on the shoulders of the individual, per se, in terms of their economic activity. Now, the thing that was the strongest vestige, I guess, of the old system was the rural urban hukou system, right? The different way of classifying household registration. Mm-hmm. So this was something that was, you know, created in the late 50s at the tail end of the first five-year plan. I'm not going to get too much into it, but basically there was a need to control the entry of rural farmers into the cities in order to, you know, prevent unemployment and unrest and things like that. But that also created a tremendous inequality, you know, which was still seen, and to an extent is still seen in China today, where urban public services and healthcare and education and so on is just much better than in the rural China. And up until Xi Jinping, there was still tremendous poverty we were seeing in rural China, the Chinese countryside. And so there was a strong rural urban divide even then. Now, Xi Jinping's poverty alleviation programs, they're famous and renowned throughout the world. That's what they were targeted at. And they corresponded not simply to like welfare and handouts, as we would, that when you hear poverty accumulation, I don't know in the UK, when I hear that in the US, we tend to think like, oh, this is the government just going to give out checks and handouts and stuff. But no, this was a very targeted, deliberate process of building up rural infrastructure, rural housing, you know, facilitating enterprise and economic activity in rural China. And this has created a very large base of consumers for internal consumption within China. So China typically was an export society that was exporting, and to an extent still is, exporting to Western consumers. Well, China under Xi Jinping has gradually begun to shift toward internal consumption. So it's a large internal consumer base. If you go to Beijing or any of the China's major cities, tourism is huge. I'd say the biggest thing you'll see is a lot of people. I mean, you want to go to a museum, you want to go to Tiananmen Square, you want to go like anywhere in China that's remarkable for tourism. majority of people that you're going to be rubbing shoulders with are Chinese people from these provinces around China that want to see their own country. And that reflects how China is increasingly a society catered to its own people, even at the most peripheral and marginal levels, you know? So I guess to answer the question, China is not a totalitarian society in the sense that like the individual is just like forced to pursue one thing or do something or meet some kind of specific goal. It's just that everything has to comprehensively work together harmoniously. You know, everything has to be part of a greater whole. So it's not that you have to meet a certain quota per se. It's more that whatever you do has to fit in with everything else, more or less. If you get a job somewhere, you know, let's say there's consequences of that when it comes to your housing and your transportation. And I mean, that's true for Western countries as well. Don't get me wrong. But there's also a level of commitment that involves, you know, and I guess, you know, what I would say is I don't think individuals really feel the pressure of the plan in China. That would be my guess. They don't feel the pressure of the plan. And that's a type of progress that they made, I guess, within socialism. Like the plan is so inadvertently a consequence of the coincidence of many different individual experiences, but it has to in some way account for those disparate experiences to produce something common. And it does. And that's what's miraculous. And so that's what I was talking about originally when I was talking about the facilitation and flow of life. It's like there's such a tremendous diversity of experiences within China and ways of life, I guess. But they are somehow accounted for in the aggregate and in such a way that they can work together harmoniously. And that's what I find so interesting.
I mean, talking about the Chinese consumer market, one thing I wish they would do is to stop buying up all the Cuban cigars. I'm a big Cuban cigar smoker. The prices have gone through the roof, and it's mainly because the Chinese are smoking.
Well, you're lucky because I can't even get Cuban cigars in the USA.
Oh, yeah, of course, because of the total embargo. Yeah. But on the question of consumerism, before I let you go here, one of the things that, you know, I've been reading a lot about Stalinism and Khrushchev and the lies of Khrushchev from Grover Firm, who I had on the channel a while back. One of the things that it struck me is that when Khrushchev tried to transition from this Stalinist focus on heavy industry and building up the base of the infrastructure to kind of ape Western style consumerism, that's where it seems to me that the USSR started to fail. I mean, and also like atrophy into, I mean, one of the things that has been quite surprising reading Stalin is that the people he's fighting with all the time are the bureaucracy, right? So Stalin fights the bureaucrats, but it feels like by the time you get the long kind of Brezhnev freeze, you know, in this country, we call it the blob, like the kind of the permanent bureaucracy. It feels like after Stalin dies, the bureaucracy kind of takes over and then tries to wed itself to this consumerism. And the USSR just couldn't, that transition just wasn't not successful. I think that's fair to say. But it seems like in China, they have been able to make a more successful transition. And maybe it's too complex a question to ask, but what accounts for it? Like, how have the Chinese been able to make this transition where the Russians were not?
Cultural revolution. That's absolutely the reason. The Chinese, I don't want to get too much into like the nitty gritty of, theory of ideology and so on and so on. But when we consume and issues pertaining to culture very much carry with them information that reinforces certain types of consciousness, which are ideological and which are ultimately types of consciousness that have political consequences. So Stalin was trying to deepen a process of reform, let's say, within the Soviet Union. I mean, the Stalinist form of economics was not completed. Okay, that was very crudely built up for industrialization. Stalin had a vision and had plans for a gradual deepening of the kolkhoz, collective farm institution, in such a way that would build up Soviet civil society and make it, you know, there were all sorts of, there was a plan for the great plan for the transformation of nature, for example. This is the foundations of ecological thinking that was already there in the late Stalinist period. So there were plans to really continue changing Soviet society in a way that would come at the expense of the bureaucrats. The bureaucrats, these guys were the ones that were promoted in the 30s. They had a very bourgeois outlook because they were just technical specialists. And they viewed the world in a very technical way. And they didn't really care about matters pertaining to ideas or great spiritual anything. That there was no real belief there, you know. And they had this kind of cynicism that just one for one, you know, the Western modern outlook, basically. So the consumerism you're talking about were these allowances that the Soviet Union made toward Western consumer society and therefore Western ideas. And that's where this whole Soviet kind of dissident movement, the Soviet dissident movement was created by Khrushchev. It wasn't civil society bursted at the seams because man yearns for freedom. No, that this urban intelligentsia, let's call them the glasses wearers, were absolutely the beneficiaries of de-Stalinization. Because Stalin's subject was the Russian peasant, the national subject, the people in the countryside. He wanted to continue uplifting and bringing those people up. That came at the expense of urban gatekeepers, right? So Khrushchev was a saving grace for these, let's call them urban gatekeepers, right? These bureaucratic gatekeepers, these intelligentsia. And the dissident movement was this like, it was like this excess that was coming from the center. Okay, so you look at the major dissidents in the Soviet society. Who were they? They were the sons and daughters of the nomenklatura. They weren't like the oppressed Soviets. The most oppressed people in the Soviet Union were the people in the periphery. They weren't dissidents. They weren't rising up or doing anything. It was people from the center. It was the nomenklatura itself that was creating these dissident kind of bourgeois tendencies. Anyway, when they made allowances to be more, you know, carefree consumer society, everything they would consume and desire to consume, the ideological baggage came with it that had political ramifications and consequences. Western soft power did work in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. It did. They did become intoxicated by the West. Mm-hmm. You know, you especially see this in the 80s. I mean, there was a fanatical intoxication. We want to be like the West. We want the blue jeans. We want the Western way of life. It was like a delusional view of turbocharged Western ideology, which totally collapsed, by the way, when they actually experienced the reality. Mm-hmm. But the reason China never did that is because for 10 years, China was coming up on and experiencing the reality that, okay, light industry is becoming a huge factor. Information society is becoming a huge factor. Cybernetics, you know, that this is changing how consciousness relates to the world. It is making the citizen, there's something in front of them that they desire. They want, they need a deeper level of fulfillment that comes from their experience, their phenomenal experiences, than just, you know, the classical modern, like, do the routine, the mechanical routine and whatever, you know. So also the West was experiencing this too with the counterculture, the 60s and 70s. But anyway, China's response to that was, you know, there is a growing bureaucracy, there's a growing cynicism, and there's this tremendous urban rural inequality that still persists. Like the Chinese peasant is still oppressed like they were for thousands of years. And Mao's way of compelling and a mass awakening of the Chinese people and the Chinese peasant was encouraging a cultural revolution. You know, it is right to rebel. Mm-hmm. Most people cynically look at the cultural revolution and they think, well, this is Mao using young people to bully his opponents in power. No, he empowered the peasant. It was the Chinese peasants in the periphery that were rebelling against the party bosses. It wasn't, there's such a focus on the students and the Red Guards in the cities. But people tend to ignore what was going on in the for the majority of China, in rural China, where there was this push for rural people to stand up for themselves against tyrannical party bosses and lords.
How much of that was kind of modeled on, because one of the things I was really surprised to read in Stalin was him organizing, quote, mass criticism from below against the bureaucrats, where he'd basically empower the peasantry to have these sessions where they basically get to kind of let the middle have it with Stalin as their champion, which to me reminded me of, it's kind of like a kind of Caesarism, or in elite theory, Juvenal would call it a high, low, middle mechanism.
It's absolutely like a Babylonian or Sumerian king relating to the farmer. And it's the same thing. I mean, there's these two tendencies in history, if you think about it. There's the oligarchic tendencies, where gatekeepers, you know, attempt to form coalitions. I don't know. You have a whole book on elite theory, so I'm sure you're kind of familiar with it. I come from more like a Hudsonian background on that, Michael Hudson. But anyway, Stalin and Mao, these are figures which are champions of the interests of the farmer, or the average Joe, let's say, right? Very much like populist. I would say that, yes, that was experienced under Stalin a number of times. So there was the 30s, during the first five-year plan. There was a continuation of that process throughout, and through the Great Purges. Even Sheila Fitzpatrick and the revisionist historians that are not communists concede that the Great Purges were a tremendous social mobility of the Russian national subject. And then the Stakhanov movement. Stakhanov movement was a populistic rebellion against the technical experts and the managers. And people overlook that. And Stalin wanted to continue and deepen this process of confrontation. The problem with Stalin is that he didn't ever acknowledge that there was going to be class contradictions under socialism in the same way. Toward the end of his life, he was thinking, well, we are tending toward a more peaceful, whatever form. So he did have these delusions later on in his life. So he didn't realize, like Mao had to realize, that no, the revolutionary process needs to be done again. And he never came to that realization, which is why, you know, Khrushchev came to power. Khrushchev was in that clique, you know, that very much feared another purge toward the end of Stalin's life. And they prevented one. Mao understood that under socialism, there needs to be a continual process of renewal. And that's what the Cultural Revolution absolutely comes from, the Stalinist tradition. Absolutely. It was a furtherance and continuation of that original revolution. Anyway, the Cultural Revolution comes into full swing, and what people don't appreciate about it is that it lasted 10 years and affected the lives of everyone in China. And people were genuinely possessed of a strong conviction and belief in their everyday routines and in their everyday lives about communism and about Marxism and so on, the revolutionary spirit and cause. It was belief that was animating them. And this was in the 70s and 60s. I mean, this is unheard of anywhere else in the world. Even in the Soviet Union, there's cynicism. It's kind of just kind of wink, wink, whatever. So here, the ideology is very much alive, you know? And it's so strongly felt that it encompasses like almost every aspect of life, you know, in a way that became untenable, you know, no longer sustainable or viable at a certain point. So what I'm trying to say is that the Chinese discovered through practice the limits of ideology, the literal limits of like how far can you go to make ideology and belief comprehensively like consume every aspect of your life and animate every aspect of your life, and what are the political consequences of that? So they discovered that through empirical practice. Mm-hmm. So when they had to suppress that, which was kind of a psychological repression in a way, suppression. Like, okay, we're just not going to look for socialism in culture anymore. We're not going to try to finely tune culture to fulfill this purity of a communist ideal. And there's more of an emphasis on the material side of things. We just need to develop the forces of production, and that's what's going to create, you know, the foundations of the future ideal communist society, which we may not feel immediately in our consciousness, you know, and in our culture. What people underestimate is that did cement almost a transcendent notion of communism that just was beyond anything you can consume. Like the, there was a feeling that no, actually communism is real, but it's just so far beyond anything we can fathom at the level of culture or immediate consumption that, you know, we should not bother trying to twist ourselves in a pretzel figuring out in the here and now. So China adopted something stronger than the Cultural Revolution fanaticism, which was a kind of transcendent ideology of communism that superseded and rendered consumption superfluous. So the intoxicating ideological effects of consumption, which are a part of culture, by the way, that took over the Eastern Bloc and the Soviet Union, did not have that effect in China. When the West was pumping Mickey Mouse and Coca-Cola and McDonald's and Western soft power, the Chinese yawned. And they yawned because above these, in, you know, these, as they should be in, working as intended, intoxicating articles of consumption, there was a transcendent notion of communism and the CPC that was just above culture. It was above, you know, consciousness and ideology in the most superficial sense. And that could not be affected or disturbed through any kind of immediate culture or immediate experiences. It's something that was very, you know, I used to, when in my research of Chinese communism, and I didn't actually start out from a position that viewed China as a really socialist and communist society when I was starting out. I used to call the CPC a transcendental brand. Mm-hmm. So kind of like in a Kantian sense of the transcendental aesthetic, you know, it's like it's this brand that is transcendent, that is a precondition of the possibility of the experience of the everyday, ordinary kind of brands that we just consume mindlessly. And it's this, it's very much lodged in the seat of the unconscious. And I was fascinated by this dynamic in China of like, how can the CPC cement itself as the transcendental brand above all the others? And, you know, it led me to really comprehensively study the Cultural Revolution and realize China achieved a type of communist consciousness or unconscious that did render even the most advanced and all-encompassing, intoxicating, and dynamic aspects of Western culture, modern culture, totally superfluous. Totally superfluous. I mean, we here in the West are creating cults, fandoms, and obsessions with video games, with movies, with stories, and all sorts of silly things that are just meant to be like luxury consumer items and goods, and we obsess over them. And this is our Cultural Revolution, by the way. Our farcical repetition of China's experience was the dumb woke shit. It was the Gamergate stuff. It was the controversies over movies, TV, video games, whatever. We are going through something China already did in a much less glamorous way, I would say. But we're stuck with this issue of like, how do we attain the virtuous and the ideal and the good through our immediate phenomenal experiences of culture, consumption, and reality, right? And that's the kind of existential question we're facing right now as a consumer society that China already faced during the Cultural Revolution. And, you know, to put it this way, it's like we have not yet been able to really discover the limits of that in the way China was during the Cultural Revolution, or we are discovering the limits, but we're just kind of ignoring the consequences and not drawing conclusions from them. And so we're just stuck in this endless cycle of, you know, you mentioned, I think, a lot of like stupidity on the right. I mean, we all know about the stupidity among leftists, right? But there's like a tremendous stupidity on the right, right? And I would say, well, what this is, it's like culture war slop. Like Matt Walsh, and it's just endless cycle and repetition of just, you know, disputes about consumption. And when there's no real way to like articulate what is the real beyond that and behind that. Now, if you're interested in the real, you're going to start thinking about systems. You're going to start thinking about technology, and like you're going to start thinking about different under the level kind of material formation. I think it's just like a realist perspective, right? You're going to think about geopolitics. Mm-hmm. You're going to think about power. I mean, you have a book called Elite Theory. I'm sure that's a much more like realistic, beyond the surface analysis of like these kinds of things. And that's what we're missing in today's politics. There's no ability to go beyond the surface. But China is long accustomed to seeing things, let's say, beyond the surface. It's very much a critical society, if that makes sense.
Fascinating. Really interesting. I still find it quite opaque, because it's so difficult to get your head around what you're talking about if you haven't been through it. Because this is like discovered through practice, through like decades of practice. So it's kind of very hard for us to put ourselves in that frame, you know, especially when most people, like you say, are just literally just arguing over, you know, demanding a higher quality of propaganda. You know, I want a woke Star Wars, or I want a non-woke Star Wars, or whatever.
It's like, it's like Star Wars for us is the equivalent of what was for them communism. Like, we want to attain and achieve this like highest and most ultimate ideal through seeing, you know, the characters and the story we want to see on TV. And we feel like this fulfills a deeper, we're looking for like this ultimate utopian solution to all of life's problems through our consciousness, basically.
So just to wrap up here, any books or resources you recommend for Westerners who want to better understand China? And I guess, I mean, you know, give us two or three, even just like Marxism in general. So where can people start?
So I don't know if this would be good for beginners, but I think Boris Groys is a great author to understand in a more kind of unconventional sense the deeper significance of Marxism-Leninism beyond the surface. So I would recommend two of his books. One is called The Communist Postscript. And I don't fully agree with them, by the way, but it does get your head turning and thinking beyond superficial ideological ways. You know, The Communist Postscript is one. The other one is The Total Art of Stalinism, which discusses the transition into socialist realism from the Soviet avant-garde. And the reason I find that book interesting is because it very much is a proxy for the transition from, you know, the kind of Trotskyite notion of permanent revolution to socialism in one country. What was the actual logic behind that? And that book was very important for me in order to understand that process. A third book that I found very important for me to understand the Cultural Revolution in today's China is called The Unknown Cultural Revolution by Dongping Han. That one's also very good. There's another book on China that would be the last thing I recommend, by the way, which is very much like debunking a lot of the myths about Mao and the Great Leap Forward and stuff. It's called Battle for China's Past, Mao and the Cultural Revolution. So I very much also recommend that one. So the thing with understanding the Stalin phenomena is that I haven't yet... Grover Fuhr, I mean, of course, I recommend all of his work. But for a comprehensive, like, holistic understanding of Stalinism, I don't think a single book has ever been made yet. I think that for, like, a total story of the Stalin thing, you have to like familiarize yourself with, you have to put together the pieces, reading like the revisionist historians, reading Grover Fuhr, reading, having like being accustomed to Russian everyday views about Stalin, which very much contrast with what we would expect from Western propaganda. When you put all those pieces together, you kind of have to figure it out for yourself.
Where can people find you, Haas?
Well, you could just go to my website, infrared.gg, and it's got everything there. You know, my X account, InfraHaas, my YouTube, which is at Infrared Show. My YouTube is going to be undergoing a revival soon, so stay tuned for that. And I also stream on Kick. So kick.com/infrared. But yeah, that's really it.
Fascinating. Well, thanks for your time. I said we'd go half an hour. We went for an hour, but it was very, very interesting. And if anybody has any questions or comments, you know, leave them there. I don't know if you I noticed that you're more on Kick than YouTube now. Is that right?
I don't stream to YouTube at all. I only stream to Kick, and I haven't uploaded on my YouTube in like a year. So I'm going to try to get something in before the end of the year for sure. That's going to be exciting, I guess.
Fantastic. All right. Well, great to meet you, and maybe keep in touch.
It was a great honor to be on, and yeah, it was a great discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank
just
you.
Just a warning, it's going to kick us out. So
okay. This is a proper good later, man. Yeah, for sure.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.